And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to hour number two of this Thursday, October 22nd, 2015 edition of the Hagman & Hagman Report. We are joined live by our guest tonight, Mr. Chris Putnam. He is an author, a speaker, a theologian,
what I like to call an intellectual. I'm going to tell you something.
Such a great body of work.
You sit down to talk to Chris Putnam, and this is not false flattery. This is just fact. I mean, when you listen to any of his presentations, they're just, I mean, I strive to be as intellectual, one-tenth as intellectual as Chris Putnam, because, I mean, he's just fantastic in terms of his understanding and his presentation of really, well, the supernatural worldview in a book by the same name, which we have right here on our, those people watching us live on our YouTube channel. You can see the books, you can see his works here, you can see his picture. We have it all up, but he's a great guy, and I'll tell you something, just a phenomenal researcher. And before we get back to Chris, I just want to mention portions of tonight's broadcast. Brought to you by American Survival Wholesale, AmericanSurvivalWholesale.com. Please, folks, visit AmericanSurvivalWholesale.com for all of your survival-related needs. And, you know, they've got the Rolls-Royce brand of freeze-dried foods. They really do. Thrive brand. And if you ever opened... Well, you can take a can of freeze-dried food, and you can fix it for your family, and they would never know it's long-term storable food. I've done it. And, of course, you know, I don't cook that much, so my family looks at me like, what are you doing? You know, cooking? Well, okay. But having said all of that.
Close thing I've seen you cooking is taking a pizza cutter to slice them up after it comes out of the oven.
Yeah. Oh, pizza, my weakness. But anyway, AmericanSurvivalWholesale.com, Christian-owned, veteran-owned company, and they're great people. It's AmericanSurvivalWholesale.com, great people. And folks, visit as well. And we really need to talk more about Katie Whelan from FamilyEssentialShop.com. That's FamilyEssentialShop.com. Need to talk more about her. She really has got some fantastic products, and my wife just loves them. Uses them
essential
all the time.
Essential oils. Yeah.
And lastly,
we use them too.
Oh, yeah. And folks, Watchers 9, the series, L.A. Marzulli, go to HagmanHagman.com. Click on the link to the Watchers 9, Days of Chaos. There, L.A. Marzulli put together this fantastic package for listeners of the Hagman & Hagman Report. Watchers 9 DVD, normally $20. The Days of Chaos, normally $20. And 3 months of their magazine, normally $2 a month. If you do the math on that, that's $46. But to Hagman & Hagman listeners only. And you got to go to the link via our website. That's the only way you're going to get this deal. $35 plus shipping and handling. And I'm going to tell you, they're going fast. This deal, do it, get it while you can. The Watchers 9. With that, Joe, go ahead and let's bring back Chris.
All right. Again, we're talking with Chris Putnam. He is co-author of several books with Tom Horn. Petrus Romanus, one of the most well-known, and Exo Vaticana, The Supernatural Worldview is another book that is written by Chris, and On the Path of the Immortals. I don't know where you want to start, Chris, in this hour, so I'm going to turn it over to you and let you take us where you will.
Well, right before the break, you asked me to talk about both of my talks I'm doing here at Strategic Perspectives, and I only got through one of them. So yeah. The second one is basically entitled, Who Are the Immortals? And I'm adding material from Immortals and a little bit from my Supernatural Worldview book as well. My Supernatural Worldview book, the basic idea, I really wrote that for two audiences. One would be non-believers who are into the paranormal, because we've seen an explosion in paranormal stuff over the last 10 years. Like in the 80s, would you have expected to see like 10, 12, 15 shows with people hunting for ghosts on major networks? You know, that would have been an unheard of thing. But now, the last count I did, and it's been a while, it's like a year ago, I found 80 shows, 80 paranormal shows on TV right now. That's how popular it is. And there's ghost hunting groups and paranormal societies all over the country now. It's just become like a new religion. It's really popular. People are searching for hope, but they don't really like this idea of being confronted with sin. So Christianity is not all that great, because then you might have to change your lifestyle. So you still want hope for the afterlife, though. Maybe we can find that out by seeing the ghosts are real. And I think that's what's driving it. It's kind of a pseudo-religion. It gives you hope for an afterlife. You can see that people are still, you know, there are ghosts. Now, I don't know if you want to be stuck haunting a house for all eternity, but maybe that's what part of hell is. I don't know. But I go through a lot of that. I unpack a lot of that. I kind of challenge a lot of ideas that Christians have been teaching for a long time, because some of them, frankly, need to be challenged. You know, we tend to think that all ghosts are demons. I don't think that's the case. I've seen too many stories where there's nothing evil going on, really. I mean, it actually saves people's lives, like children, that a ghost was involved in, supposedly. So there's too many of those for me to assume it's all just demons in disguise. I don't think that's the case. I mean, I'm talking about cases with pastors, C.S. Lewis, Bible translators, theologians, Christians, you know, who have experienced ghosts. And I think they're telling the truth. So I put those right in the forefront of the book, too. So that's part of that. But it's mainly my idea, my thesis, is that it's shifting in America, especially. We are all been indoctrinated with naturalism, philosophical naturalism, that all that exists is nature, and that humans aren't souls. We're not embodied souls, as the Bible teaches. We're just meat computers. Our brains are just like meat computers, and we're animals. And we just evolved through a process of millions of years and survival of the fittest. But there's nothing really special about us. We don't live out immortality in heaven and hell. Those are all just based on the fear of death. And people have made this stuff up to make themselves comfortable. And that's the way most scientists look at it. And that's the way most universities will teach you to think. Okay, but that's changing. And there's a lot of things driving that change. One of them is all the evidence coming from the near-death experience. So I have a whole chapter on that. But there's some incredible evidence from near-death experiences that prove that you survive bodily death, at least on a temporary basis, because they've killed people on the operating table on purpose, and those people were able to relate the conversations the doctors had when they had a flatline EEG. I mean, literally, word for word. And they could describe the instruments and the surgery and all of it. And they had a flat EEG, meaning their brain was dead, and their body temperature was cooled down to 60 degrees. And they had ear sound-emitting earplugs in their ears, beeping really loud. So if you hook up to an EEG and you hear a loud sound, it spikes because it shows brain activity. These were flatline, okay? And these people overheard conversations, and they knew knowledge that they couldn't have had unless they were conscious during that time, outside of their body. And so, and these are documented cases in operating rooms. And the one I'm talking about is a real famous one. Her name's Pam Reynolds. You can look it up on the internet. Look up the case of Pam Reynolds' near-death experience. It will shock you. But I think it proves beyond a shadow of a doubt that you have a soul, and then you can leave your body. So this kind of evidence is stacking up. And it's stacking up in hospitals, and medical professionals are testifying to it. So people are realizing that the idea that you're a meat computer and you just die and rot in the ground just cannot be true. But at the same time, they don't want to accept the idea that they're sinners and that they're bound for hell unless they accept the gospel. That's not a comfortable notion either. So they're inventing kind of a new religion. And it's really a pantheistic sort of God is in nature sort of thing. And that's really where we're heading as a country. That's what Oprah Winfrey teaches. That's why she's so popular. And that's what Joel Osteen is basically selling, because he doesn't talk about sin very much either. He just wants you to be happy and successful. So this is what Americans want to hear. Yet at the same time, so many people are out looking for ghosts and the paranormal. So we're seeing a paradigm shift. And I labeled it the paranormal paradigm shift. And it really is showing that we're shifting from naturalism, from atheism, over to a spiritual worldview, but not a Christian worldview. Okay, so I think that's ongoing. I think that's for sure. I think there's plenty of evidence of that. Now, how does that tie into, you know, my talk on who are the immortals? Well, the immortals are the ones that are driving this. If you remember, and when I say immortal, I'm really talking about fallen angels most of the time, but I like the word immortal better because angel is just a Greek word, angelos, which is transliterated in English to mean angel, but in Greek, in the New Testament even, sometimes it's just a regular human being, is an angelos, and they use the word messenger, and that sometimes it's a divine being, a supernatural being, and they'll use the word angel, but in the Greek, it's angel for both. It just means messenger. So it, over time, in Christian theology, we started calling it angelology, like the study of angels in theology. But not all angels look like humans. They're not all messengers. And some of them, the seraphim, look like serpents. A seraphim is a winged serpentine being, okay? And there's no doubt about that in the original Hebrew. You know, it scares people to think, wow, in the heaven, in the throne room of God, there are flying snakes? Yeah, there are. And that's what Isaiah describes in the throne room of God. The seraphim are flying around singing, holy, holy, holy. They have six wings, but they're like snakes, okay? Then you have the cherubim. Now, these are the beings that have four faces. They have a human face, an ox face, a lion face. I mean, these are scary-looking things. These are not messengers. If God sent one of these to talk to you, you would probably run. But the ones that, you know, you see in the New Testament, like at Jesus' tomb when the stone was rolled away, they do look like humans. Like when Gabriel came to talk to Daniel, he was like a shining, bright human being. He still kind of scared Daniel because Daniel could tell he was supernatural, but he was human-looking. He wasn't, you know, he didn't have four faces. He wasn't a snake. He wasn't any of these things. But so it seems kind of silly to me that we classify all these different kinds of beings, there might even be other ones we don't know about, as angels, because they're not all messengers. It's a messenger is a job description. It's not a type of being. So I don't like it. I think it's a mistake that we ever started calling it that. Immortal is more accurate, and that's why we titled it that, because these are created beings. They're not eternal. God's eternal, but there's a psalm, I think it's Psalm 145, I could be wrong about that, but just from memory, Psalm 145, 147, somewhere in there, it talks about the Sabah, which is host, it's a military term, and the Malak, and that's the Hebrew word for angel. And it says that he created them. And it also says that he created them not to die, okay? So they're immortal. Immortal means you don't die, but it does mean you have a beginning. So they're created beings, but they were created to never die. Now, it gets really interesting. And I really appreciate all the flattering things you said at the beginning, and I wanted to say that, you know, all the things that I know, I learned from other people, and Chuck Missler's one of them, and another one, Dr. Michael Heiser, who just came out with a new book as well, called Supernatural, and then another one called The Unseen Realm, Restoring the Supernatural Worldview of the Bible. So I will give Mike credit for my title, The Supernatural Worldview, because that's where I heard it first, was from Dr. Heiser. And he was my Old Testament professor in seminary as well. And he talks a lot about God has a divine council of immortal beings, that he sits in a council. It's in the Bible, and you can find it in several places. One of the main ones is Psalm 82, and this is what makes it interesting about the immortals. So Heiser's exegesis is in Deuteronomy 32. There's a passage. Now, it gets interesting because it's controversial. If you look in your King James Bible, it's really something that Moses wrote, and it says, when God divided up the nations according to the number of the sons of Israel. Now, he's talking about the Tower of Babel. God did not just confuse the languages. He actually he disinherited the other nations. He disinherited them, and he assumed Israel as his chosen people in order to use them as an example to the others. And this is why God was so upset when the Israelites would worship the foreign gods and behave like the Canaanites. He was so upset because they were supposed to be the counterexample. They were supposed to be his people, not the people of these other foreign gods, who actually do exist, apparently. Some of them are idols, but I found that these demonic beings will assume the role of an idol if we create it. They'll give it life, in other words. They're happy to assume the roles. But anyway, getting back to the Deuteronomy 32 worldview that Mike talks about, is that At no time in history did God divide the nations according to the sons of Israel. In fact, at the Tower of Babel, there were no sons of Israel. Okay? If you think about it, that's Nimrod time, before Israel. So that's probably a bad translation in the King James there. But look at the ESV. It says, when God divided up the nations according to the number of the sons of God, the B'nai Elohim. This is the same beings in Genesis 6 who procreated with human women and created the Nephilim. All right? The sons of God. These are divine beings. These are the beings on the divine council. Some are good, some are evil. You know, some went their own way, followed the devil. Others are still on God's council. They're holy angels. Okay? But in Psalm 82, read it carefully. God sits in the council and judges among the gods. And the judges among the gods is a little g. It's not a capital G, it's a little g. He judges the gods. He says, you've abused your people, you've mismanaged them. Your punishment for this? You're gonna die like men. That's their punishment. So that goes right along with what I'm saying. That they were created to be immortal. But in the end times, when it all goes down, some of these fallen angels who disobeyed God, who misled the people, who became false gods to the other nations, they're going to die like men. He's going to take their lives, even though they're immortal. That's what that Psalm's about. Look at it, Psalm 82. It kind of changes your view of the Bible a little bit when you start to get into some of this death, but it's all throughout the Old Testament that there is this divine council. And if you look in the book of Daniel, it's a good example. When Daniel prayed and Gabriel shows up, he says, you know, we heard your petition and we've been trying to get here. I would have got out here sooner, but I had to fight the prince of Persia for 21 days. And I wouldn't even have been able to win if Michael hadn't come and helped me. Those are your guys right there. It tells you there's a prince of Persia. Okay, that's a god over that nation that they worship. Okay, who's a false god. I think that's one of the examples of these people, these angels that are going to die like men. Okay, it could be that prince of Persia who withheld Gabriel from coming to Daniel. So there's one prime example you see in Scripture. So the idea also is that Michael is the immortal who defends the Jewish nation, okay? And that's all throughout. If you look in Revelation 12, there's a battle. There's a heavenly battle between Michael and his angels and Satan and his angels. And so you can see that is going on right there as the backdrop of the Battle of Armageddon. So when I wrote the Supernatural Worldview, I'm thinking, okay, we believe we're near the end times. We believe they're coming soon. We can see lots of evidence of that with Israel and everything else that's going on. That means this battle in heaven could be ongoing, or it might be happening soon. I don't really know how long it lasts. It might be ongoing right now. But if that's the truth, and Satan and his angels are battling Michael and his angels, don't you think they're going to ramp up their strategy on Earth? And isn't that a pretty good possibility to explain this paranormal paradigm shift? See, remember that movie, The Usual Suspects? And
oh,
that
yeah,
line
absolutely.
Was, the greatest trick the devil ever pulled was to convince the world he did not exist. Now, that's the naturalism. That's what we've been indoctrinated with in the United States all throughout our educational system. But I think that's changing. We're starting to see overt paranormal activity. There's been headlines in newspapers about demon possession. These near-death experience things are happening on a regular basis. Scientists are starting to change their mind. The devil's not pretending like he doesn't exist anymore. So I think this is indicative of the lateness of the hour, but I think it's also why we're seeing so much paranormal stuff, is that these immortals are changing their strategy. And we're going to start seeing overt, miraculous things happening. It's going to deceive a lot of people. And that's why Jesus is saying, don't let anyone deceive you. And it's why he says false prophets will appear, doing false signs and lying wonders. Paul talks about that in 2 Thessalonians. Yeah, maybe that's why Pope Francis is doing what he's doing. I don't know. I don't think that he's intentionally evil. I don't get that impression, but I think he is mainly out of ignorance because he believes Catholic theology, honestly. And I have big problems with that. And I express them pretty forcefully in the book Petrus Romanus. And I could defend them, but, you know, I don't like to bash people that are Catholic. I think there are a lot of saved Catholics that they just don't know that the doctrines of their church are anti-biblical and really anti-gospel in a lot of cases.
I just wanted to say this. Chris, you make a good point. We're talking about tradition and man-made doctrine versus really biblical biblical insight in Catholicism. I'm sorry. Go ahead, John.
No, I just want to say the Pope in some of his statements, Chris, I don't know how familiar you are with some of the things he's been saying. You know, he said a personal relationship with Jesus outside of the Roman Catholic Church is dangerous. He said things, you know, like we will baptize the aliens when they come, and
right.
I mean, he's been.
They also said that Muslims are saved.
Yeah, an atheist can go to heaven.
The Catholic Catechism says that Muslims are saved. Okay, but they don't even believe Jesus died on the cross. So how could he die for their sins? It's stupid. It really is. Their catechism says that Muslims are saved just because they believe in a creator. But the Book of James says, you believe God is one. Good for you. The demons do too, and they shudder.
you know, I
don't think that helps.
Yeah, I'm telling you, Islam is a pretty schizophrenic doctrine.
Yeah, it is. I mean, how can he say that Muslims are saved when they deny that he died on the cross? They say somebody else was up there. They deny that he died for our sins, that he was ever buried or ever was resurrected. They deny all of that. That is the gospel. And they overtly, the Quran overtly says that's false. So if you believe the Quran, there's no way you can be saved.
Exactly, yeah.
I don't see any way around that. Logically, I just don't see any way around that. I mean, I wish it wasn't that the case. I wish you could just be a good person. And he say, but the Bible does not teach that.
No, exactly. And to your point about the paranormal stuff, I just saw on one of the headlines on Drudge here the last couple of days about the show. They're coming out with a program now. I didn't really read the article, but I saw the headline about a show that's featuring exorcisms, and they don't even know what to.
I heard about that.
Yeah, and they're saying
they're going to do exorcisms live on television. Live exorcisms.
Oh boy.
Not reenacted. They're actually going to do a lot live exorcisms on TV. Yeah, I blog about that on my supernaturalworldview.com. I think I put a post about that on there.
What could possibly go wrong? Seriously. What could possibly go wrong?
Yeah.
Well, what I proposed in my blog, I just now remembered, you know, I've studied that area quite a bit, and Arnold Fruchtenbaum is a theologian I read a book about demons and demon possession. He was talking about the possibility of demonic transference, you know, even by accident, just by being in the same room. Like, the demon might jump from that person into you. Now, I don't know how this works exactly, but say a million people are watching that on TV. Can demonic transference happen that way? Because think about those pigs. When Jesus cast that demon out of that man in the cave, and it jumped into a herd of pigs, what is it, a couple thousand pigs or something it said? I can't remember. It was a lot. Okay, and all those pigs ran off a cliff and committed suicide. It jumped into the lake, right? Okay, so if that man had 1,000 demons in him that killed 1,000 pigs, and a million people or watching a live exorcism on television, is it possible that they could transfer via TV and demonize a million people? I don't know. But
I don't know
that it's not possible. If it could happen to the pigs with Jesus, could it happen on television? I don't know. But do we want to find out?
No, not at all.
I don't want to watch it, to be honest with you.
No, there are some things I think that we are not to dabble in, and that's... I get the deliverance ministry. I understand that,
exorcism is valid, but making money off it with TV ads is different. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, I think some forms of exorcism are valid. I don't know about the Roman Catholic version, but deliverance ministry might be a better way of saying it. It is a real thing, and it does help people. And there's documented cases of I've got a book that I've been trying to work on the side. It's really astounding, this case. I'm just going to mention it, and hopefully I'll have it in print by next year or so. But there's a case. There was a guy who really believed he was a woman trapped in a man's body. He was one of these transgenders. He was convinced of it, and he had been for most of his life, and he acted like it and everything else. And so he scheduled surgery to remove his male parts, and then he was going to take estrogen or whatever and try to turn himself into a woman. You don't get a woman, by the way. You get a mutilated man when you do that. But he was going to turn himself into a mutilated man and pretend to be a woman. But one of his friends, who was a Christian, just convinced him, kind of on a lark, to go to a deliverance thing and see if it helped. So the day before the surgery, he went to a deliverance ministry, and the guy cast a demon out of it. He canceled the surgery. A year later, he was married to a woman, and he's never turned his back.
Huh. That's fascinating.
Never turned his back on it. Never had any inclination to feel like a woman again. And he's married to a woman. He's a man. And, and that's a true story, and it's got medical documentation. So, I think that this stuff happens a lot more than we think it does, and we just kind of dismiss it because we live in a country that doesn't believe in it.
It seems like our tolerance, I mean, Americans especially, or the West, we've got this tolerance to sinful tolerance, I'll call it, and it's really, I believe, demonically inspired, and that's, to look at homosexuality not as an aberration, but a right, or transgenderism, to look at that as, hey, you've got a confused individual or someone who's unsure of their sexuality, let's help them out, as opposed to let's cast out the demons that caused this, which is what I think really why we're here today. I mean, the immorality, and if you can speak on, and we're just having a conversation here, ladies and gentlemen. Chris Putnam is our guest, supernaturalworldview.com and logosapologia.com. It's off of our website, or, I think that was the right, okay. All right. Both linked off of Hagman.com. But if you can speak to, the demonic with respect to current events, domestically, the abortions and the homosexuality. I mean, my goodness, we just had this June 26th, a Obergefell opinion, Supreme Court opinion. It's supposedly now the law of the land, which that's a whole other subject, a whole other direction of discussion. But, we are really living as the days of Noah, aren't we, at this point?
Yeah, we are. If not even worse, to be honest with you. I wonder how bad it was then compared to now, that now we have such technology. I mean, we could blow the world up several times over just with the atomic weapons we have. So at least Noah didn't have to worry about that. But you're right, that the rampant immorality in my lifetime, I've seen something that was, considered a disgraceful, embarrassing thing turn into a virtue. And when we're talking about homosexuality, it's like now it's cool or something. I don't really understand how that happened. And I have compassion for these people who feel this way. Okay. I don't blame them for it so much, but it's a disorder, people. I mean, don't tell me that it's normal. The plumbing doesn't even match. I mean, it's obviously something wrong with this. Sex obviously is for procreation. It's not the only reason we do it, but it's there's bonding in marriage and really healthy reasons for it that God designed it for. It's pleasurable, sure, but obviously, the orifice that's meant to expel death is not where you're supposed to insert the instrument that's supposed to create life.
Well said, as
possibly can.
Yes.
And so obviously there's a problem with that. It's not God's design. It's against the created order. I know that you might have feelings that are against that, and I can have compassion. I have sinful desires, but I have to fight them. It doesn't, just because somebody's an alcoholic, doesn't, we don't just say, go ahead and drink all you want. We tell them to quit, and it's the same situation here. They might not be able to help them if they could feel that way. I understand that. It doesn't make it right. It doesn't make it right, and it doesn't make it okay. It doesn't make it acceptable. It doesn't make it healthy. And I use what I call argumentum ad absurdum. It's basically you accept the premise of your opponent. Okay, you accept what they're saying, and you say, let's just believe what you're saying, and we'll take it to its logical end. okay? And it's called a reduction to absurdity. And I think it proves that their position is absurd. What they're telling us is that homosexuality is a healthy, normal behavior that some parts of our society have. It's healthy, it's normal, there's nothing wrong with it, right? Okay, so here's my argument to absurdity. If something really is a healthy behavior, then it should be just fine if everyone adopted it, if it's healthy, right? There should be no problem with everyone in the world doing it, okay? So if we accept that it's normal and healthy, then it should be acceptable that everybody does it. So if everybody became a homosexual, the human population would disappear in one generation. There would be no people left. So obviously that's absurd, and it's not healthy. So it proves that the first point can't be true, because if you take it to its logical conclusion and everybody did it because it was healthy, then obviously we would cease to exist as humans. There would be no people left. So it can't be healthy. It's something wrong with it. It's what I call it, and I think it's a generous term, is a sexual attraction disorder. And if you look at the diagnostic manual that doctors used back in the 70s, I think it was the DSM-2 or 3, it changed. I think mm-hmm. 2 called it a disorder. And I think 3 might have been the one where they changed it. And they said that now it's not a disorder, it's okay. But doctors used to universally call it a sexual attraction disorder. And then the gay lobby, the liberal agenda, the politicians influenced the doctors to say that it was normal. But it's not normal. It obviously can't be.
And in the DSM-5 now, they have a belief in God listed as a mental disorder.
Do they really? Yeah.
Yes, they do. And a lot of people aren't catching that. They don't know that.
That's terrible.
But I believe, Joe, correct me if I'm wrong, is that not an extreme, or are they not, well, it doesn't really matter, but I thought they were talking about the extreme view of being...
No, they were, it's been a while since I've read it, at least a few months, but it talks about how, a belief in a creator or a supernatural entity and basing your life decisions and how you live with that belief as a mental disorder.
Yeah, okay. All right.
Chris, I wanted to ask you about the resignation of Pope Benedict.
Oh, yeah. We got a lot of questions about this.
You and Tom Horn came on our show, and you guys called it right on the money and said how, talked about the Pope resigning, and it was the first time in 600 years a Pope's resigned. In your research, what has Pope Benedict been up to at the Vatican, and what's his role behind the scenes?
That's a good question. Honestly, I don't know a lot about what he's been doing. But I have something that's connected that's really interesting. Just in the last, I just want to make sure I get the names right. I have this in a file right here. But there's a cardinal, and that's why I can't remember his name. Let me look this up. Okay, Pope Benedict. We said that we thought the papacy would change in April of 2012. Because of a prophecy, and a Jesuit had written a book predicting it, and we went on a limb and wrote that, and it didn't happen in April 2012. We thought, I guess I was wrong. And then in February, I believe, of 2013, he comes out and announces he's retiring, and then he says, actually, I told a small group at the Vatican that I was retiring in April of 2012, but there was so much controversy going on with the bank and all that, we didn't want to bring it up then. He actually did exactly when that prophecy said. Now,
wow.
It turns out right now, there's a cardinal. I'm going to give you the name. I'm going to find the name right now. But there's a cardinal who just read a biography. And he says he was part of a small group that was kind of like the mafia, his words. And they did not like Pope Benedict because he was too much of a traditionalist. He was too hard on gays. They want to have homosexual priests. These guys do, these cardinals. Pope Benedict is too much of a hardliner. Let's get rid of him. And so, here's the cardinal's picture. What's his name? Godfrey Daniels. I think it's pronounced, or Dan, it's like, he's Belgian, so it's D-A-N-N-E-E-L-S. All right? He read a biography, and he says that he was in a mafia club that bore the name St. Gallen. They wanted to reform the church, to liberalize it, make it more modern, and they wanted Cardinal Bergoglio from Argentina to be the new pope. Okay? So they really had a conspiracy to push Benedict out of the office and get Pope Francis in there. And this was done years before he stepped down. So they had been working on this. Now, if you remember it in our book, Petrus Romanus, we quoted Malachi Martin talking about a group of Luciferians who did a parallel atonement ceremony back when Paul VI was sworn in. They had nations and apostate satanic Catholics and some secret hideaway in Charleston, South Carolina, and they called in long distance somehow and hooked up to the Vatican as Paul VI was being enthroned as Pope, and they did some ritual, supposedly turning the office of the papacy into an instrument of Lucifer. This is written by Malachi Martin, who was a Jesuit and advisor to three popes. Okay, he was still considered a priest when he wrote this. And I don't think he was lying. He wrote about it several times. He called the group the Superforce. And he also called it Lucifer's Lodge. And there's a book by William H. Kennedy by the name Lucifer's Lodge, and he was an assistant of Malachi Martin. Now, he says that all of that, a lot of that pedophilia, then maybe not all, but most of it was ritual sex magic that they were doing with children. These priests are not just getting their rocks off or whatever. They're actually doing satanic rituals, having sex with children. Okay, so this is what was going on in Charleston while Paul VI was being sworn in. All right, and with a specific purpose of making the papacy an instrument of the devil. Okay, and if you look at, in the new book I'm working on right now with Tom Horn, I trace every pope from Paul VI up to Francis. Every single one of them, even John Paul II, who was an enemy of the Soviet Union, but every single one of them has promoted Marxism to a very high degree, the redistribution of wealth, and world government. Okay, every single one of them, without exception. And I quote their own encyclicals and their own speeches at the United Nations and make that case, because it's their own words that make the case. It's not my opinion. They're all for world government, and they all have Marxist ideas about the redistribution of wealth. And I think that that is directly related to that ceremony that happened in 1962-63. And I think that we're seeing the fruition of it now. I think that this very well might be the final pope. And he's openly calling for redistribution of wealth. And he's calling for a war against ISIS. I mean, directly. He's using all the terminology from the Catholic doctrine of just war, the exact terminology, and I show that in the book as well that I'm working on right now, that he wants a war with ISIS. And he's not being as caustic as the prelate in Russia. He's not calling it a crusade, but he still wants the war. And you know, like I said, I don't think ISIS is really the problem. They are a problem, but I don't think they're Armageddon necessarily, but they're leading toward it, and it's really leading more toward this new world order. And it's going to turn on the Jews and the Jewish people, and they're going to, you know, it's going to be a battle over Mount Zion, basically, I think.
Chris, since you mentioned ISIS, and we keep, it amazes me to listen to newscasters, to people in the media, in the print and talk media, to refer to ISIS as ISIL or IS. And, you know, it seems that there's an evolution of that.
I'm just calling
them
IS now, yeah.
But yeah. I guess my question is this, I can't shake the desire to research and keep researching the fact that we're talking about ISIS, the Egyptian god,
Islamic State.
You know, make that comparison.
ISIS, it was like the Islamic State in Syria and Iraq, right? Is that what it stood for?
Well,
and then it was ISIL, the Islamic State in Syria and Levant, or something
Levant,
like that, right?
Right.
Elvis or Levant. Yeah.
Right.
But, yeah, I just went with in the book, I decided I would just go with Islamic State because it's too confusing to keep changing the name all the time.
Right. But I guess my question to you is the conception of the name. Is there any reason for me, and I'm asking this really, you know, in an open forum here, is there any reason for me to continue? Does ISIS, when it was conceptualized and named ISIS, does that signify some sort of nod to the god ISIS, you know, small g god ISIS?
It might. I mean, you know, if it does, it probably wasn't their intention. But, you know, I'm a real big believer that our battle is not against flesh and blood, but against powers and principalities and spiritual wickedness in high places, okay? So when I'm talking about Pope Francis or Vladimir Putin, a lot of times I don't even think these guys probably don't have bad intentions. I think they probably think they're doing it right, even, when they're not. My point is, they're being driven by supernatural forces that are influencing them, and they don't understand it exactly. They're being misled. They're being deceived. They're being steered by immortals that have an agenda, and it's leading to a one-world government. It's leading toward Armageddon, and that's the way I see it. I don't want to blame Pope Francis and say that he's the Antichrist. He's the epitome of evil. He might be, but I don't think so. I think he actually thinks he's doing what's right, probably, but he doesn't realize how deceived he is, because he's not preaching the gospel. He's preaching social welfare. He's preaching Marxism. I mean, if you listen to what he says, he thinks the world's problems are due to an inequitable division of wealth. You know, it's not fair. He's right. It's unfair. It always has been unfair. But you know what? It's not going to be fair because of Pope Francis. The only person who's going to restore things to make things right is Jesus Christ. And that doesn't happen until, you know, quite a few judgments are underway.
Exactly. Wow. Well, and I'm getting back to your book, Petrus Romanus. And folks, there are so many... so many things that Chris Putnam has written about Pope Benedict, Pope Francis, Petrus Romanus, and Chris, you've got on your website, I believe it is, let's see here, on the, well, all of the books here, but Exo Vaticana, definitely, please, ladies and gentlemen, if you are so led, get the Chris Putnam's books, because there's so much insight into all of this, and I don't know. I just, as Joe mentioned, I think back, Chris, to the time when you and Tom Horn and I think Steve Quayle were on our program and talking about the Pope resigning and wow, you know, it was just shortly thereafter, you know, you hit the nail right on the head,
Take a look at this article. All you have to do is Google this title: Anti-Benedict Conspiracy. All right, it's in the AmericanConservative.com website. And it explains this cardinal in Brussels who says he was part of a secret club to get rid of Pope Benedict and put Pope Francis in office. And you'll see right there that it was by conspiracy. Now, the thing that makes that more interesting is that he chose the name Francis. Popes pick their own names, right? And, you know, we were wondering which Francis he meant, because there was a Francis of Xavier, who was a Jesuit, who was kind of a nasty character at times. And then there was St. Francis of Assisi, who probably was a Christian. I mean, he seemed like maybe he was, I think. But St. Francis also delivered a lot of prophecies, and I got a copy of that. And he says, during the time of these tribulations, there will be a man non-canonically elected to the pontificate. Non-canonically elected. Now, with a conspiracy of cardinals pushing out the other pope, making him retire, qualify as non-canonically elected? I kind of think so. So St. Francis, his namesake, who he named himself after, said this: during the times of these tribulations, there will be a man non-canonically elected to the pontificate, and at these times, Jesus Christ will not send them a true pastor, but a destroyer. Okay? This is St. Francis of Assisi, hundreds of years ago, wrote this. At the time of these tribulations, a non-canonically elected pope, Jesus Christ, will send them not a true pastor, but a destroyer. And so I have a chapter that I just finished writing called Pope Francis, the Destroyer. And I don't mean that he's like dropping bombs on people. I mean it, that he's preaching liberation theology, Marxism. He's undermining a lot of morality. He's saying things like, when they asked him about pedophile priests and homosexual priests, what did he say? Who am I to judge?
Exactly.
Aren't you supposed to be the Pope? I thought that was your job. And then, you know, what did he say about atheists? He had a debate with an atheist in an Italian newspaper, and he says, atheists could please God and go to heaven as long as they obey their conscience. He said that. Pope Francis said that. Now, if you look at the book of Hebrews, it says, without faith, it's impossible to please him. For those who, to approach God, you must believe that he exists and that he rewards those who seek him. That's what the Bible says. Pope Francis says, obey your conscience. What does the Bible say about your conscience? The Bible says the heart is deceitful above all things. Who can understand it, right? So where does he get this stuff? Atheists are saved by their seared consciousness? Come on. I mean, that stuff, it's just like, to real Christians who know the Bible, it's almost stupid when you read that. But he's a serious person, and a lot of people, he has a lot of power, and he has a lot of influence. So we should take him seriously, even though he says stupid things.
Well, and it's the, and I look at this like the same way. I look at the Pope right now in the Vatican, the same way I look at Obama, for example. People look at Obama and think everything's about Obama. Obama's making a lot of decisions. Obama's saying this and saying that. Well, I look at Obama.
Weird. Yeah.
Right. I mean, but there's a lot of people around him. So the same with Pope Francis.
Uh-huh.
There's a lot of people around him.
Yeah.
There's a circle, a sphere of influence, you know. So it's interesting.
There's that and that supernatural influence I'm talking about, too. Keep that in mind.
Very much. Yes. Yes. And
yeah.
So what you're saying, and I think Joe would agree, what you're saying is it looks like everything is lining up where this one world religion that's necessary for one world order could very well be ushered in by Francis, by the current, you know.
Absolutely. He's doing everything he can to make it happen. He had Islamic prayer services in the Vatican.
Yeah.
Okay, this is a religion that said Jesus never died. He never died for our sins. He never resurrected. But he allowed them to pray with him in the Vatican, and they conducted Islamic prayer in the Vatican. At the same time, he was meeting former Israeli Prime Minister Simon Peres and a Muslim. And they were talking about peace in Jerusalem. So, yeah, I think that if anybody I've ever seen in my lifetime has a chance of doing it, it's him. I mean, he could... And Michael Heiser, my really big intellectual influence I was mentioning earlier, who I think is brilliant, biblical scholar, one of the best out there. Michael Heiser wrote a book, and he didn't publish it. It was kind of a self-published book. He wrote it way back, right after 9/11. It's called Islam and Armageddon. It's real hard to get. I got it because I'm one of his students. But Mike Heiser, back then, his opinion was the Antichrist will be the guy who settles the conflict between the Muslims and the Jews. And I think that's probably what's going to happen. I think somehow, like I said, the Quran does say the Jews will regather in Israel near the end times when the Mahdi shows up and Jesus comes back. So honest Muslims have to admit that Jews have a right to be there. So this whole thing with the PLO and all that's not even Quranic. Doesn't even agree with the Quran. So at some point, I think they're going to get taken out of the way. Maybe the Israelis will wipe them out. I don't know. Maybe it'll be the Psalm 83 war that Bill Salas has talked about or something of that nature. But somebody's going to somehow bring peace between most of, and probably not all of them, but, you know, the majority of Jews and the majority of Muslims. And, of course, the Catholic Church will be right there in the middle. It's Pope Francis negotiating the deal. So there you have, you know, what most people would call Christian. And, you know, and then from there, you build a third temple complex up on the Temple Mount representing all three religions, and there you are. You know, and it's really, it can happen pretty quickly the way things stand right now.
Wow. Very good. I just pulled up Dr. Michael Heisner's website here. Very interesting. What was the name of that book again, that's out of print or
it's
hard to get?
It's Armageddon, and you'll never find a copy.
Well, thanks.
Yeah,
okay.
I'll send it to you.
Yeah, oh, man.
Okay. And I might do that. It's really good. I'm going to quote it pretty liberally in this book, but Mike's opinions probably have changed a little bit, so I don't want to misrepresent him or anything, so I want to be a little bit cautious about that, but and maybe ask him if it's okay, because it was a self-published book, and I think he read it over 10 years ago, maybe, something like that, so he might have changed his positions, and he might not want me to
sure
to say that he said that. I don't know, but I think he would still stand by the idea that the Antichrist will be the guy that negotiates that peace covenant, because you know, in Daniel 9, the famous 70 weeks prophecy, right? It says that he will make a covenant for many, with many, right? Do you remember that one? A lot of people think that's the Antichrist making a covenant with in Israel, and that will be the first, that will be, you know, what gives the Antichrist all his prestige, and the world will think he's this great peacemaker. And then halfway along that line of 7 years, he turns and the whole thing goes south and leads right to Armageddon.
Well, Chris, let me ask you, is it, just to be precise with the terminology, is it negotiating a peace settlement, or is it confirming a covenant, confirming an existing covenant?
I don't know. I mean, a lot of people have interpreted that differently, so I can't say with authority that that's exactly what it is. It sort of sounds that way. A lot of dispensationalists have interpreted that covenant with many as something like that. And it seems to make sense to me that that's what it would be, because it must center on Jerusalem and the Jews if it's Daniel's 70 weeks prophecy, right? So, I think the purpose of the tribulation is basically for the Jews to come to the realization that Jesus really was the Messiah, and that's, you look in Zechariah chapter 12, and it says that God's going to pour out a spirit on Jerusalem. I'm just paraphrasing, I don't have it in front of me, but that they're going to look on him who they pierced, and they're going to mourn for him like one mourns for their firstborn or something like that. Do you remember that verse? They're going to look on him who they pierced. And so that's the Jews recognizing that they crucified their Messiah in Zechariah 12, I'm pretty sure. And then, from 12, you get to Zechariah 14, and people's flesh is melting off their bodies from Jesus coming back at Armageddon. I mean, it's not much of a battle. It's more like he comes back and says, "Drop dead," and they melt. And it's not a pretty sight. But Armageddon, I think, is described fairly well in Zechariah 14. But start at 12, and you'll see that what instigates it all is the Jews realize that they pierced the Messiah, and God's going to have mercy on them. There's going to be a remnant that he saves from that realization. I'm not John Hagee. I'm not saying Jews are saved just because they're Jews. I don't believe that. They have to believe the gospel. But once they see that Jesus was the Messiah and they pierced him, like Zechariah 12 says, then they're going to believe. That is the gospel. I mean, they're going to realize that it was all true. And once that happens, all bets are off. And we're going to see the Antichrist turn on them, probably. And you're going to see, bloodshed and the Battle of Armageddon. You're going to see Jesus come back on the clouds of glory. And, with probably the raptured church and a whole bunch of immortals. And, the people that oppose him aren't going to last long.
Wow. Chris, we are up against another top-of-the-hour break. Folks, you're listening to the Hagman and Hagman Report. Excuse me, on this Thursday, October 22nd, 2015. Author, speaker, theologian, Chris Putnam is our guest. He is the author of several books, some co-authored with Tom Horn, and some by himself, The Supernatural Worldview.
I wonder when he sleeps.
I know. On the Path of the Immortals, Petrus Romanus, Exo Vaticana, just a fantastic body of work. We'll be right back with our third and final hour with Chris Putnam on the other side of this break here on Global Star Radio Network. Stay with us. I queued us out a few seconds early.
That's all right.
Here we
talk
go.
Amongst ourselves.
Here we go.
This is the Global Star Radio Network.